Welcome to Tech Tuesday on All Sides with Ann Fisher. The video conference service Zoom saw the number of users increase from 10 million in December to 200 million in March in response to social distancing requirements to slow the spread of the coronavirus. Zoom is easy and convenient to use, making it popular for everything from college courses to business meetings to social meetups with family and friends. But the app isn't as secure as first thought. Lily Hay-Newman is a senior reporter at Wired Magazine. She's been covering the issue. Welcome to the show, Lily.
Hey, thanks for having me.
So Zoom is safe for most people. So walk us through some of the issues and concerns that have come to light.
Yeah, I mean, I think that is the big takeaway is that for most people, they should be, you know, considering it to be safe for their regular use. But some issues that have come up, first of all, relate to this idea that Zoom is now being used as more of a town square for more public events versus just, you know, conference rooms, business applications, things like that. So there's been an issue that people are calling Zoom bombing, where people get the Zoom ID, the meeting ID, sometimes just because it's been publicly advertised, like to do a, you know, storybook reading or something like that. And they jump into the call, share their screen, and, you know, show something disruptive or upsetting on the screen. So that's one example of things that have been going on. Researchers, security researchers have also been probing Zoom a bit more and looking at it more closely because so many people are using it. And they've had some findings as well, you know, just from that expanded scrutiny on the service.
You're listening to Tech Tuesday on All Sides with Ann Fisher. I'm talking to Wired senior reporter Lily Hay-Newman about Zoom right now. It's extremely popular in the era of social distancing because of the coronavirus outbreak, but it has its weaknesses. If you have a question or comment about Zoom, give us a call. Lily Hay-Newman is here to answer your questions, 614-292-8513, or email us at allsides@wosu.org. So how did they do more a deeper dive on this? What were they looking at?
There have been a number of different things researchers have found. One of them was that the way Zoom had done an integration with Facebook, the product was sending some data to Facebook that Zoom doesn't even seem to have realized it was sending. And it seems like in the process of doing that integration between the two companies, that data flow kind of got established. So Zoom has removed that, you know, they still have that Facebook integration, but without that data stream. But, you know, things like that, as researchers look at the product more, look at the data that comes in and out of it, look at how meetings are secured, and then look at Zoom's own claims about its encryption, its security, and try to kind of vet that against what the researchers can see in practice. Those are all different kinds of ways that researchers are starting to, you know, tug at the thread and have a bunch of stuff come out.
What can Zoom do? I mean, is the basic app the same for town hall meetings as it is for getting together with my friends for a happy hour on Friday? I mean, is it the same technology?
Right. It is pretty similar. I would say one thing people really appreciate about Zoom, and one of the reasons it's become so popular, is that even the free tier of service provides a huge amount of functionality and crucially can support a lot of streams, you know, a lot of attendees to a Zoom call. So it's honestly pretty amazing that for free, they're offering 100 streams that can all be attending a meeting. So that's a real benefit to users. There are some differences with the tiered, you know, paid product. And there's a special version for education, you know, with sort of flexible pricing and all different types of things that they, some of them do have different default settings for how the meetings are set up. And that can help with security and by, for example, I was talking about Zoom bombing before, you know, with people barging into meetings. Some of the tiers have it set so that the screen sharing people do to display disruptive content is disabled by default instead of being enabled by default, so anyone can share their screen. Changes like that. But overall, the product is pretty similar across all the tiers. And that, again, is something people view as a big benefit when they're just trying to get something working quickly.
You make the point that it's free. A lot of it's free. But the human rights group Access Now wants Zoom to release a transparency report to tell users how the data is being used, because it's nothing's free. I mean, they're using the data. Right. They're selling it.
Right. And I think the other thing people are interested in with a transparency report is to have a better understanding of the types of law enforcement access requests that Zoom has faced. The company says that your data is always encrypted and that they have safeguards in place so that Zoom employees, you know, aren't decrypting the data. And so they're not being forced to decrypt the data, but because they don't have a transparency report that shows the requests they've gotten and how they responded to them, we don't really know in practice what Zoom's position is on all of this or how they handle data.
And when you talk about law enforcement access requests, are you saying that the law enforcement's requesting records of conversations people are having with each other?
Potentially, it could be sort of like a wiretapping thing, like, you know, patching in to calls, things like that. It could be written chat transcripts from calls. We just don't really know what Zoom has been asked to do, if anything, and how they've responded, because they don't have a transparency report currently, though they've said that they plan to add one.
Zoom has also stopped saying that everything's completely encrypted from soup to nuts. They have another phrase they were using that was inaccurate. What's the difference?
Right. So there was a big confusion and a feeling of frustration in the security community because Zoom was using the phrase end-to-end encrypted to describe their product. And it additionally had this feature you could turn on where once you check that box, then it sort of said end-to-end encrypted in the top left corner. And people were surprised by that because most enterprise-grade, massive video conferencing services like Zoom aren't able to achieve full end-to-end encryption, which means the data is totally encrypted from the time it leaves your device to the time it arrives at your chat, you know, friend's device. And everywhere in between, no one can decrypt it. It's a setup that exists. It's possible, but doing it at scale, like 100 people, 1,000 people on a call, is pretty almost impossible right now, very, very difficult. And so it was surprising to people that Zoom was claiming that, because no one would have thought that Zoom would be end-to-end encrypted. It's just not sort of the industry standard for a product like this right now. And they have, you know, now that people have sort of brought this up and said, why are you calling it this? Are you really end-to-end encrypted? Zoom has walked that back and they've said, you know, we were using that phrase in a non-standard way, and we regret that we did that, and we shouldn't have done that.
Is Zoom working with Skype on something now?
I don't know.
Okay. let me ask you this. How is Skype? Skype was the former, we're on Skype right now, by the way.
Yeah,
the favorite for a long time. How Skype's fallen behind on with Zoom. How is Skype working to catch up?
I see. So yeah, Skype, I mean, I think it's still a really popular product and, you know, possibly even more popular than Zoom in some markets. But the real thing that I see as the differentiator for Zoom has been just the number of people they allow on a call. In total, I believe Skype's top end for enterprises is 250 streams on a call. And like I said, Zoom's is 1,000, which is for a paid, you know, product. But so I think a lot of those things have been the differentiators, you know, in terms of why people have gravitated to Zoom. But I think Skype is, you know, maybe just riding on the brand recognition and name recognition they already had. Uh-huh. And I think they've had uptick in usage during the pandemic as well.
Does this negative news about Zoom, has it affected usage by everyday people very much? Do we know yet?
I don't know specifically. I do know that some organizations like New York schools are reconsidering use of Zoom in light of this news. And I think the security community has pretty mixed feelings about that. You know, on the one hand, it would be great to say everyone should only use the maximally secure product at all times. But on the other hand, not everyone really needs that level of protection for their, you know, daily life. And the protections in Zoom to reduce things like Zoom bombing or people, you know, coming into the call without your permission, there are protections you can add. So I think the security community feels like, on the one hand, it's good that these criticisms are coming up so that Zoom can fix the problems and become more secure. But on the other hand, you know, consumers shouldn't necessarily be inconveniencing themselves or burdening themselves to scramble to find something new to use, because in a lot of use cases, Zoom is adequately secure. So you don't want to have the wrong takeaway from this discussion.
Zoom CEO apologized. Is that, that's not unusual. I mean, but they promised that they're going to fix the problems, and people seem pretty satisfied by that, right?
Yeah, I think the security community has been very satisfied so far with Zoom's response. They've been very quick to fix sort of smaller bugs or smaller issues that researchers surface. You know, Zoom will have them fixed in a couple of days. They've been just very sort of responsive and on top of this. So I think that has sent a good signal. And the CEO has also, as you're saying, you know, made public statements, but also specifically seemed open to continued discourse and, you know, to having researchers submit as many bugs as they can find. So I think that attitude has played well.
And then just one more thing, the app, one of the things I thought was interesting, that is, if you join a Zoom meeting through a regular phone call, so you just, you know, right, you just click on the link, you don't get the same kind of protection as if you're, maybe if you start the Zoom meeting or if you have the Zoom app. Why is that a difference?
Right, it's true. I think conceptually it might feel a little daunting or complicated at first, but conceptually I think, you know, people can get to a place of understanding this. You know, when everything is within Zoom's software, like when you're using either their mobile app or their desktop app or, you know, their web portal, something that Zoom designed, all of that can pretty easily be within their encryption scheme. Again, you know, there's still questions about exactly how that works, and there's sort of still a discourse going on about that. But conceptually, that it's easy for all of that to be controlled by them and be part of their security scheme. But when you add in something like a phone call, you know, when you call in to a Zoom rather than doing it through their software, you're then adding on the whole legacy telephony network, or sometimes we're talking about conference room bridges, you know, enterprise equipment. When you add in another sort of technology or waypoint in the call, it's more difficult for Zoom, but, you know, it could be any service. Conceptually, it's just difficult for a software company to extend their software there because, right, you know, the legacy telephony network is existing. It's not owned by Zoom. It's, mm-hmm, you know, it's this sort of massive distributed thing. So that's the reason that when you add in third-party elements like calling in on the phone, Zoom can't just magically extend their security scheme all the way. They still take steps to encrypt as many portions of the call as they can, and other video conferencing services do the same. But yeah, it's worth understanding that, mm-hmm, calling into a meeting on the Zoom app is different from calling in on your, you know, your smartphone's phone call mechanism.
Lily Hay-Newman, thanks for joining us today. I appreciate it.
Yeah, thanks for having me.
Lily Haynum is senior reporter for Wired. She's been reporting on the problems with Zoom, although it hasn't stopped the service from reaching an incredible number of people just in the last couple months. We are going to continue with Tech Tuesday on All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. Welcome back to Tech Tuesday on All Sides. I'm your host, Ann Fisher. Some call it the coronavirus economy, that rapid, nearly overnight acceleration from traditional brick-and-mortar establishments to online work, education, and retail as millions stay home. Even before the crisis, a record 9,300 stores had closed amid widespread bankruptcies last year. Some will never reopen in a world that has gone from real to virtual. Drew Harwell is a tech reporter at The Washington Post. He's been covering this. Welcome back, Drew.
Hey, thanks for having me.
So what kind of signs do we look for when it comes to figuring out if this online shift is permanent or how much is temporary?
It's sort of hard to know, right? Because we're in this, you know, purgatory of a lot of people socially distancing, working from home. There being this huge divide between kind of the privileged many who do get to work from home and have those, you know, office jobs, and the others who do sort of depend on that real face-to-face contact that have to go in and in some ways have to put themselves at risk. You know, but the early signs we're seeing are, you see a ton of smaller businesses, locally, you know, oriented businesses, restaurants, bars, bookstores that are just really struggling. They're having to close up or they're having to change how they do business just to survive. You look at all the energy pouring out of those small businesses, but then you look at, you know, on the flip side with the Amazons and Walmarts, these just ginormous companies who are hiring hundreds of thousands of people to help with the surge of business. And, you know, in that way, really quickly gaining power, gaining, you know, people and personnel and, you know, potentially setting the stage for the future where even more people are working for them and contributing to that big business clout.
You know, I remember shopping in a little beautiful store in a little town where I did not expect to have such a lovely store. And she said, well, actually, I just kind of threw this together because most of my business is online. I decided to have a brick and mortar so I can go to a small town. It's cheaper to do it from here. Do we know if that was much of a trend going ahead and that people like her might survive?
You know, I think what we're seeing is there's a lot of creativity among the smaller businesses. I think it's really easy to write them off entirely. But from some of our reporting, we're finding, you know, these restaurants are starting to offer takeout. These bookstores are offering, you know, we'll deliver books and puzzles and toys to your house or you can come pick them up. They're finding ways to survive that are really interesting. But, you know, the present reality is so different from what they depended on for so long. And, you know, just the true, like, investment in infrastructure in terms of real estate and personnel, and all of that is shifting for them really quickly. And so, you know, a lot of these businesses are really just wanting a time machine to jump from this present suffering to the future when hopefully their business can come back. But in that meantime, it's really going to be hard. Can they survive in the same way? And can they make it out, you know, and prosper later on?
So this is a heyday for tech, though, right?
It sort of is, because we're all forced to use their products, right? You know, and there's some feeling like this tech lash that some in the press talk about has gone away because tech is our lifeline to the rest of the world. We're all Zooming and chatting and, you know, using Amazon to get products delivered to us. And so, you know, we're seeing the value in our life, and these tech companies are capitalizing on that. And, you know, they are creating products that people need or want to use, whether it's school or work or social life. So you are seeing a ton of money go to that. And, you know, there's a question of, are we all going to be working from home later on, even after this outbreak ends? Will we sort of see that, you know, we've gotten over the psychic barrier that kept us going into the office, and, you know, now we can just work from home okay? I think that's going to be a big question. How much of this is really sort of a paradigm shift, and how much will just snap back to normal?
Well, and you mentioned privilege earlier, and one thing we take for granted in the big cities is broadband capacity. That really varies from household to household, even in the city. And then once you get to the rural areas, it's not even possible.
Yeah, absolutely. And, you know, I think that's going to be a huge have or have not barrier. You're already seeing it in schools where, you know, there are a lot of college students who are going back home and they don't have great internet. So all of the online learning that they're expected to tune in for and complete, they're struggling in a way that, you know, their peers may not be. And that goes into grade school, that goes into, you know, working life for people. You know, we do take it for granted that we have, you know, quick and easy internet in urban areas around the country, but there are whole swaths of the country that do still struggle with that. And so, you know, are they going to be left behind while the rest of the country sort of shifts online? I think that's a really worrying, you know, a worrying sort of barrier there for a lot of people. And I'm not seeing any way for them out of that.
Yeah, I mean, I'm wondering if it can be left behind. I mean, it is a wide swath of the country and it's held back those. But I'm wondering, can it forge ahead without them either? Is it, and, you know, the state's been Ohio's been grappling with this issue of rural broadband for years now, and nothing ever really seems to get done.
Yeah, it's always been a question, should big business be stepping up? Should government mm-hmm. be mandating there be sort of standards for this in terms of how people can connect? And we've just sort of seen these stuttering moves to get people online. And now we're talking about 5G and all this stuff. So it's, you know, I think I'm hopeful that this is a moment where we sort of see that as a priority, because, you know, the internet is the way a lot of us are going to be living our lives for, you know, the rest of potentially time. Mm-hmm. But, you know, I do worry about the kids and the people going home and being expected to work from home or study from home and not having that capacity and just having that natural disadvantage compared to everyone else.
So who besides Zoom is hiring in the tech world these days?
You know, anything that has to do with streaming, you know, services that you can do at home to maintain whatever normal you were pursuing before then are doing well. So anything around, you know, education, testing, streaming, video, entertainment at home, even fitness at home, you know, companies like Peloton, you're seeing those get some enthusiasm, because there's a feeling like, you know, they're going to get this natural energy right now from all of us being under lockdown, but they're also gonna, you know, benefit from after this moment when people say, well, I'm just gonna fold that back into my everyday life. So you are seeing those tech companies prosper, but you know, it's at the you know, these other companies are sort of at their mercy. You're seeing this with restaurants who are having to, you know, kind of grapple with the Grubhubs and the delivery services that are, you know, have their own business models, their own, you know, cut of the delivery fees. So, you know, these big tech companies are sort of growing, but they're also sort of eating into the natural base that these small businesses depended on for a long time.
Telehealth is something that, you know, people have been reluctant to do. And by the way, insurance companies have been reluctant to cover, but it's now required due to social distancing. And I'm wondering if you think that the insurance industry is going. Telehealth is one thing. You know, telehealth is a couple things, though. It's video and it's telephone to conversations with physicians and healthcare providers. Is there a sense that that's going to get a better foothold?
There is a sense of that, because, you know, you talk to medical providers and they feel like it's sort of silly how long it has taken for the insurance mandates to catch up in terms of what they'll pay for telehealth and televisits. And, you know, in a lot of cases, these are a perfectly fine way for people to get care, a way for, you know, patients to maximize care from home. And, you know, you think about the scenarios for a lot of outpatients right now where they're just not able to go into a hospital or clinic, and telehealth is the only way they can keep going. We've seen some sort of hopeful early signs that the insurance companies will step up and be sort of paying in rates, but But right now, you know, the hospitals are really struggling. There's, you know, we see the hospitals sort of overrun with COVID cases, but everything else, they're really, you know, business, you know, hospital healthcare in America is a business, and they are struggling with lower revenues just like everybody else. So you're seeing cuts in that way too. So yeah, I am kind of hopeful that telehealth will be a benefit of this as well. But that goes back to this divide in terms of internet ability too, and mm-hmm. even just sort of technical ability. Not every patient, young or old, has the wherewithal, or the sophistication, or the technical ability to use a telehealth call. They can maybe go over the phone, but you know, getting that video ability is something else. So you know, I'm hopeful that there will be, you know, an interest from the insurance companies to pay for it, but I'm also hopeful that there's you know, a similar push from tech to make these systems more accessible and not just focus on the people who already can contribute to that effort.
You know, I've watched some free concerts. Artists and performers locally and nationally are streaming their performances online. They're performing on social media, but they're also trying to make it sustainable and profitable. They're doing GoFundMes. They're asking people to pay for it in other ways. What is your sense about how this this kind of strategy, how survivable is it?
Yeah, I love to see it, you know, and it's really interesting seeing artists be innovative in this way. You know, part of me is skeptical that it'll ever make up what they were making before. And, you know, I'm also sort of wondering, you know, it's great to do these live stream things, but I think we're going to reach a point where we're just burned out of looking at a screen all day.
Yeah.
We're all, you know, staring at a screen through the day, yeah. through the working hours. Kids are staring at screens for, and then, you know, we shift from one screen to the next at night now to watch these things. So I'm wondering if we're going to hit a point where we just say it's too much. And that was always, you know, well, I think we're all starting to appreciate what we took for granted before, going out to a restaurant on a Friday night or going to a yeah. concert or a museum even. I'm dying to go back to a museum. Mm-hmm. So, you know, there's just some visceral parts of reality that are just not replicable on a screen right now. But I think as a stopgap, it's great. You know, we can't just sort of lay down and die and let these businesses just go to zero, especially because there is such uncertainty around when we can return to something resembling normal. So I think it's great that they're doing it, but I'm worried that it'll be, you know, too little too late.
I think it's interesting that esports was just getting to that point where it was attracting large crowds of people to watch competitors compete, and now it's all back to square one in a way, right?
It is, and yeah, in some ways it is the only sport left for people to watch. So I'm kind of curious whether its audience will grow in any way. Esports is such a strange thing, right? I mean, watching other people play video games, it's not something, you know, I think mainstream America has totally come around to yet.
Well, it's all I can do, but go on.
Yeah, right. Yeah. But like, there is a huge growing fan base, and it's not just kids. You know, there's billions of dollars being poured into esports, and you know, the games are becoming more accessible. The entertainment packaging around it is becoming closer to something like ESPN. There are people to follow. There are characters. There are storylines. And, you know, and all of the games are not just, you know, sort of shoot 'em ups either now. Mm-hmm. There's a diversity there that is attracting lots of bigger audiences. So I think, you know, there might be some momentum to where people will start tuning in because, hey, it's something new. It's something exciting. So I'm curious to see, you know, we may not be able to pack in stadiums for these esports events, but will people be turning on from home to be watching these things? Will they be invested in a way that they never were before? I'm really curious to see how that goes.
Yeah, you know, you know, you talked about going to restaurants and stuff, but I also think that we like to go see things together. We like, you know, otherwise, how would theaters survive all these years when you can watch anything at the, you know, at the flip of a switch on your home television? I still like to go to a theater and watch everything. I just wonder what's going to happen to all of that and how slow will it be to come back?
Yeah. Yeah. It's a huge question mark right now. I mean, we've talked to people who feel like it's all going away. The internet will be the main relic in our life that is all consuming. But, you know, we talked to other people too who feel like we're going to be appreciating theaters and restaurants in a way that we didn't really before when hopefully all of this shakes out. And so, you know, I think there right now are entrepreneurs and businesses trying to think what will be the real attractor for people after this ends. There's obviously a ton of energy going into the internet right now and finding ways for tech to replicate those experiences and take up these new businesses. But I think there's also, you know, a feeling of what will be the real, you know, things we can leave our house to see. What are those just you know, experiences that are impossible to put on a screen that people are going to be dying to patronize again. So, you know, the only thing we really know is that this is going to be a huge pivotal moment in our lives in terms of how the economy is shaped and who are the winners and losers. And so I'm just curious, like, how will we as sort of Americans kind of come out the other side? Are we going to be just dying to leave our house? Or are we going to be feeling like, you know, this worked out pretty well for us and we should just keep it going?
And what has history taught us about previous crises and how they've changed things?
You know, around the American workplace specifically, you've seen, you know, this moment right now is kind of unprecedented. But, you know, you look back to these big, you know, you look back to 9/11 even and see how it sort of changed the security infrastructure of going to the airport even. The things you never would have expected to do in a TSA line just became kind of the new normal. But you also look back to, you know, 100 years ago with the Spanish flu and see sort of how social gatherings changed. And you look back to, you know, these huge factory fires too, where those, you know, created some of the basic workplace regulations that we depend on now. And so it's interesting seeing these huge moments in the past that were really paradigm shifts for how we work and live in this country. And, you know, you start to realize, like, we're in another one of those moments right now. And it's really hard to see when you're in it what the big residual effects will be and what these ripple effects will be for how we all live. But I think that we're in that time now. And it's you know, sort of anybody's guess in terms of what will be left standing in the years ahead.
Drew Harwell, thanks for your time today. I appreciate it.
Yeah, thank you.
Drew Harwell is a tech reporter for The Washington Post. We have more Tech Tuesday coming up with Russell Holley, so stay with us. This is All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. Welcome back to Tech Tuesday on All Sides. I'm your host, Ann Fisher. Final Fantasy VII Remake was years in the making. Earlier remakes didn't inspire much confidence, but the latest is giving fans something special to celebrate. One reviewer is calling it a masterpiece. Here to tell us more, Russell Holley, contributing editor at Android Central. Welcome back, Russell.
Hi there.
So you like Final Fantasy VII Remake?
Yeah, and I want to make it clear to the game nerds who are listening, I actually never played the original Final Fantasy, but my best friend did, the original Final Fantasy VII. He played every single day, and I would go over to his house, and he would play, and I would sit and watch. So, like, I knew the story and everything, but I never actually sat down and played. I didn't own a PlayStation at the time to play it when it first came out. And we have heard about a remake for this game since 2015. When 2015 came out, they said, you know, that they were going to redo this game. It was going to be a complete, you know, kind of remake from the ground up from this game that is now years and years and years old. I think When I first came out, it was 1997 was the original release of Final Fantasy VII. Uh-huh. You know, so it's been a little while, and they did this complete remake. You know, video games looked a little different back then, not quite as graphically intense, and so they're spending a lot of time making sure that every aspect of this is you know, kind of almost movie quality, realistic, and you know, very pretty, and you know, fixes some of the game mechanics from the previous version. So they made a lot of promises when they first announced this back in 2015 that it was going to be this big thing, and they've been working on it you know, longer than that. But over the last couple of years, it's been, you know, kind of slowly teasing slightly more information, and now that it's here, it's one of those things that you feel like has been talked about for so long that it's impossible to be as good as. As good as everyone wants it to be, because people who, you know, this is the same kind of nostalgia problem that we run into with movies and video games right now, is, you know, is this going to be you know, a really great recreation of something like the She-Ra remake on Netflix, or is this going to be you know, something, you know, very, very disappointing like the Sonic movie? You know, so it's you know, kind of tough to see where that's going to go, and you know, this is the first part of what will be three different, you know, parts to this game, and it's very, very good. It's just, if you have if you happen to be in a place where you have you know, 40 or 50 hours to kill because you're not allowed to go outside, for example, this is a really great way to spend it.
What is the storyline? What's the plot?
Well, this show is not quite long enough for that.
Okay.
you play a character who is on a, you know, kind of self-exploration journey and trying to save the world from a giant calamity, and in doing so, he partners up with a bunch of people that he meets along this journey to try and take on this big evil thing together. Is kind of the highest level. But honestly, it's like answering that question in a way that you would. That most people would be able to understand would probably take the full hour of the show.
Okay. And what made it so beloved from the beginning?
The story was really compelling. There were characters that were a lot of fun. Okay. It was at the time, you know, visually very pretty. And then, like many Final Fantasy games of its time, it spends a lot of time giving you this really great character that you like and then killing it. That you have this kind of deep emotional attachment to a character. And if that was a spoiler for you, then, you know, it's been 20 years. so yeah, it's a big thing, to be excited about. If you're a fan of Final Fantasy VII, if you've never played before, it is still a really great thing to pick up and try, because it is very different from the original game in many, many ways. But yeah, just a really pretty game that came out at just the right time for people who, aren't allowed to go outside.
Your reviewer said that the combat makes you feel like you're the choreographer of a real-time big-budget anime movie.
Yeah, all the visuals for this, you know, it's designed to just feel like you're watching, you know, a really high-end animated movie. And the gameplay is designed to be kind of constant. So you're kind of constantly moving in between each one of your characters and you know, giving each one of them instructions to do. And as you go and give them instructions, they go and kind of build up and do those things. And the end result really is this kind of choreography that happens on screen. It's visually very appealing.
And it can play across different platforms?
No, right now this is a PlayStation 4 exclusive. Gotcha. It may be something that comes to Xbox at some point in the future, but that's not something that's being talked about right now.
All righty. Skype is trying to take a page from the playbook of Zoom. Zoom may be getting all the attention. We just spent a whole segment on it earlier in the program. But there are privacy issues with Zoom. What about Skype?
Skype definitely has fewer privacy issues. The inherent, you know, one of the things that makes Zoom so appealing is it's not tied to one of these big companies, right? So it's not something that has ties back to Amazon or Google or Apple or Microsoft. It's kind of this separate thing that companies don't have to feel like they're investing in some larger corporate giant. In order to use Zoom, Skype is obviously tied to Microsoft. Microsoft acquired them for quite a bit of money several years ago, but really hasn't done a ton with it since then. You know, it was hoping that this would be kind of the big chat system, but I feel like it kind of lost some direction. Mm-hmm. And with Zoom, you know, just being explosively popular over the last month, it was something we talked about last week. Was there were going to be companies who were going to look and go, okay, what lessons can we learn from this? This is the first of those things. You know, there's now a thing called Skype Instant Meetings where if you are on your computer, you can start a Skype meeting, and instead of requiring every person to be your friend on Skype, you can just drop a link somewhere. And it kind of instantly starts that conversation with someone. It makes the invite, very quick and very instant, not a lot of, kind of jumping back and forth or you know, ringing calls or anything like that. It's a lot of the hurdles that originally existed within Skype, even recently, have been done away with and make this significantly easier to kind of dive into in the same way that Zoom can be, kind of seamless and allow you to just kind of work.
So does that, though, affect the security of Skype?
Well, you run into, essentially the same problem that you run into with anything that is link-based, in that it doesn't require an account to join. Mm-hmm. If you share the link, it doesn't require, if you can, the link is private by default, but you can publish that link anywhere. And so if you put the link somewhere, then it's possible for someone to kind of drop in without technically being invited, depending on where that link is shared. But it's worth pointing out that the URLs for this are a lot harder to kind of accidentally stumble into, which is part of the thing that was happening with Zoom bombing was people were, figured out the pattern for links and then were kind of jumping in.
So do you need to have a Microsoft account or download from a Microsoft store, right?
In order to have a Skype account, then you want that. But if you just want to jump into an instant meeting, then no, you don't require that.
Okay. Well, we shall see how Skype responds to the demand going forward. You wanted to talk about a projector for people who want home theater. It's called Vava.
Yeah, so no one can go to the movie theater right now because they're all closed.
Yeah,
and that has actually led a ton of people to kind of improve their home system. In order to kind of enjoy things a little more with the family, maybe they need a bigger TV in the living room, or they need a better sound system so that they can get more of that experience where maybe they weren't home a whole lot previously. And especially folks in smaller apartments or places that don't necessarily have a great big family room, it is becoming clear that going out and buying a great big expensive television is just not convenient right now, especially with social distancing in place. Having someone that can help you lift that giant television is a little on the complicated side. So this is actually a pretty decent alternative. It is what's called a short throw projector. And what that means is it's a box that lives close to the wall instead of on the other side of the room. And it uses laser projection to actually project the TV image that you want onto either a wall or a screen without taking up a whole lot of space.
It's 120 inches with it. I guess that's the diagonal measurement, right?
Correct. It's 120 inches diagonally at a 4K resolution.
Okay. It's not cheap though, right?
Well, it's certainly cheap by 120 inch television standards. It's definitely, it's a projector. Projectors end up being a little less expensive than their television counterparts because there's often some quality differences. Mm-hmm. And the same is true here. It's $2,800 for one of these projectors, which is definitely not cheap. But again, once you start, increasing the size of your television above 80 inches for 4K, you get pretty close to that price anyway. So you're already looking at that range if you want a television that's, within this size range to begin with.
So describe 4K resolution, though. How does it compare to, a 56-inch TV or something like that?
Yeah, so I mean, what you're seeing here is pretty much the standard for high-end televisions right now.
Okay.
Anything that goes above, kind of a 40-inch television, you kind of expect it to be at this resolution.
All right, that's not bad. What do you think? Do you think something like this is going to get a foothold because of the pandemic?
I don't know that the pandemic is. I think the thing that the pandemic is motivating is people realizing that they're going to be at home for a while, and so the television that they use, maybe once a week and are now using a whole lot more, they have felt the need to upgrade. And I think that that's where stuff like this is coming from.
Okay. I'm really excited to hear about the Bowflex C6 bike. It's an indoor bike. It lets you hook up to an iPad. It looks compact. Tell us about it.
Yeah, so this bike is with kind of an answer to a bunch of problems that I ran into.
I obviously cycle a lot and can't do that right now as often as I would like to. And a solution there was kind of an indoor bike. And obviously, when you were looking for the big thing that you see on television and in recommendations is a Peloton bike.
Yeah.
Peloton bikes are almost $3,000. And the screen that is attached to them, that's built in, it's a nice, beautiful screen. It only ever does the one thing, and that's the stuff that's in the Peloton operating system. So it'll show you courses from Peloton and allow you to interact that way. But that's literally all it does. If you want to watch a movie while you're riding a bike, or if you want to, you know, change the scenery or something, you're pretty limited on your options with the software that's included in Peloton. What Bowflex does is it takes a lot of the same mechanical features that exist in the Peloton bike and allow you to bring your own screen and bring your own software. So I can take my iPad and stick it in the you know, carrier that comes in this thing. And if I want to use the Peloton service, I can. If I want to use an online group riding service called Zwift, spelled with a Z, I can. And then I can actually, you know, with friends who are also kind of remotely stuck at home, we can ride together through the streets of London or New York in this kind of virtual environment that ends up being a lot of fun. If I'm interested in, you know, performance and just kind of improving myself, there are tools called Trainer Road. And these apps connect to the bike via Bluetooth. The Bluetooth cadence sensor and a Bluetooth power meter and a Bluetooth heart rate sensor are all included in the bike. And they feed information to the tablet, which then feeds it to the software to give the software the, you know, more accurate information.
You like it.
I'm a big fan of the way it works. Earlier this morning, I did 15 miles through London with a friend of mine while watching Sherlock Holmes: The Game of Shadows at the same time. So I can do the picture in picture thing with the iPad and have the movie running while I'm riding with a friend of mine. And that may speak to my desire to have more distractions than are probably necessary while riding a bike.
No kidding.
But it was great. You know, I was able to do 45 minutes on the bike. I felt like I got a great workout, and you know, this fits in the corner of a pretty small bedroom with, you know, without a whole lot of extra work. And it's something that it's not just something for me. So, you know, a lot of my cyclist friends say that I should just get an indoor trainer. It's something that hooks up to the back of my, you know, very nice bike that I have. And allows me to do all of these same things through that.
Right.
But it's that then becomes something that only I can use. So if I want to share with someone else in my house, if I want them to be able to you know, get a ride in on their own as well, they're not going to want to climb on my bike. My bike is a seat that is, you know, not only prohibitively expensive, but designed specifically for my rear end, is you know, sized to me, and so is just not friendly for multiple users. Whereas this is something that, you know, anyone in my house can jump on and ride and create their own account and their own software and do things their way. And that, I think, is really important.
Will this work with any version of the iPad, or do you need, or any other kinds of tablets?
This will work with anything, any screen at all. If you have a phone that you would prefer to use, if you have an Android tablet, if you have an Amazon Fire tablet, you know, any of those things can connect with it. The iPad just happened to be what I had, you know, nearby.
And the bike itself feels good, feels solid?
It's a really great bike. It feels actually very, very similar to the Peloton bike in the way that it works. It has the same, you know, magnetic difficulty knob that you use to increase for when you want to make it feel like you're going uphill.
Uh-huh.
It has pedals that have both a hook on one side, a clipless mount on the other side. So if you have, you know, kind of the clipless shoes that you use for high-end bikes, that is already compatible with you know, the pedals that are on this bike. So that it really is something that works for just about anyone.
All right. Well, that's good to know. Russell, Holly, all things are well with you?
Everything's good here, aside from, you know, being stuck indoors like everyone else.
All right. Well, stay healthy, take care, and hopefully talk next week.
Absolutely.
All right. That's Russell Holly, contributing editor at Android Central. And that's it for Tech Tuesday today. Thanks so much for listening. This is All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News.